If they arrive wearing a suit, that probably means that they paying disproportionate attention to form. And it's just kind of an unwritten rule in most of the venture capital world that, those are the people you shouldn't back. The real entrepreneurs don't really care much how they dress and what they look like, but they care deeply about the problem that they try and solve.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen. How is it going? My name is Gray Jabesi, and this is another episode of the Gray Av podcast. And I have to start with an apology for not posting the podcast for the last 3 weeks. I was traveling. I was in Kenya, then I was in Malawi, specifically for market research. Like you guys know, I'm really interested in Africa. And, using technology as a solution to some of the problems that we have. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there. And the best way to actually understand what's going on instead of, reading the articles or the statistics, it's best to just go and observe what's going on the ground. So I did that, and it was a good experience. And I could have actually posted, but, one of the drawbacks that comes with being a little bit of a control freak is that you tend to slow down when you lose control, because I'm used to putting the podcast myself, to publish them myself, and even write the little blurbs on the website myself. And this time my sound engineer actually managed to send me the podcast, a couple of episodes on time that I could have published, but then I just didn't have the chance to, open up my laptop and publish a podcast, write and share it. So maybe that's something that I really should work on, because based on the lessons that I've learned over the time I've been doing this podcast is actually, to delegate some of the things that you don't really need to do. But I digress from that. And today we're just continuing a conversation that I had with Dr. Michael Jordan. For those of you who don't know about that episode, you might want to go back to episode number 90 and start from there, because it was great and instantly became one of the most downloaded podcast episodes on the Gray Av. So I definitely recommend it. The first part, we talked about banking, career development, and business a little bit. And today we're certainly going to talk about Montegrea Capital Mo, his venture capital firm, and some of the investments that he has made in Bank Zero that's coming up, and Rain Mobile, which is a lot of people in South Africa are probably familiar with already, because it's a company that's set to actually disrupt the data market, in the mobile data market. Because it's a problem in South Africa, actually a serious one. I was traveling Africa, like I said, recently, and you'll be surprised that data in Malawi is cheaper than in South Africa. That's absolutely not right. So anyway, let's get into it. And just to give you a little bit of a background, Dr. Michael Jordan is the founder of Montegrea Capital, and he serves as a partner at Angel Hub Ventures. He has more than 20 years experience in the financial services sector. He served as CEO at First National Bank, or FNB, until December 31st, 2013. So I think that gives you some sort of an idea. But anyway, enjoy my conversation with Dr. Michael Jordan. And remember, you can stream as well as download the Gray Av podcast. You can stream on iTunes, podcast app, SoundCloud, and all these podcast platforms, but you can also download it and listen to it offline on your own time from my website. That's greatjabesi.com. So I'll let you to it. Enjoy my conversation with Dr. Jordan.
Right, and from that, now you moved into venture capital.
Yes.
Why didn't you just retire? You live in Stellenbosch.
Yeah.
You live on a farm here, right?
Yeah, I do. And it's a wonderful life here, and, wonderful mates, and you can go mountain biking with them, and they're great restaurants, and I'm quite involved in the wine trade as well, although my wife runs the entire wine business. So it's a wonderful life. But I do think that one's sense of self-worth is not dependent on things that you did in the past.
it depends on what you do every day. And, you know, for good or bad, I do want to just play a part, a positive part in making the world around me a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way in which I can do it is by helping entrepreneurs who are solving some of those problems out there. So I do think that maybe I had the schooling, and with that schooling, I particularly mean also my corporate period, where I realized how important people are, this selection of people who are better than you, the identifying of people who get things done. So it's not just about coming up with good ideas, it's people who can actually implement those ideas in the real world. And then trying to sniff out the good investment opportunities too, to say that, you know, if I invest in this business, there is a chance that that money will multiply over time. So I have to say, I'm in many ways living the dream, living my dream of, you know, doing good things that make the world a little bit better with very, very interesting people, you know, the entrepreneurs that do it.
Mm.
That is also intellectually stimulating and hopefully in the end also financially rewarding.
Right. And then, so, I mean, the banking's, in the banking sector, it's different from what you're doing now. I mean, you're used to people coming to you and giving you money. And now you have to look for entrepreneurs or projects that you think are worth something, and you put your money into it. So now you have a complete opposite of, like, okay, now you have people who are desperate for money coming to you, which is exactly the opposite. How did you make that switch now?
I need to say I'm still learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, this venture capital game is a very interesting one. I've read so many books about it, spoken to so many people. And while the basics are simple, i.e., you know, find a new idea in a market that can grow very fast, that is a very big market, where the individuals have some track record. Those are the basics. But discerning which are the ones, very difficult. I mean, we get many, many applications a day, maybe at least 10 new deals a day from all over the world. If people find out that you have capital to invest, they come.
Mm-hmm.
And out of those 10 deals that you get a day, you may end up doing 2 or 3 a year. Like, I mean, that really is the ratio that you do. And even of those deals that you do, the accepted wisdom in venture capital is that for every 20 investments that you make, 10 won't even make it. 1 or 2 or 3 will be okay, and 1 or 2 or 3 will be such that, you know, it makes it worthwhile for the entire type of portfolio. So your question is it different? Yes, it's very different. So people do come to you, and you can't say yes often enough. So as I say, yes, 2 or 3 out of hundreds that you get a year. And then the payoff profile is very different than it would be, for example, when you do lending. In lending, you can have a bad debt ratio of 1 or 2 or 3%, whereas I just made the point that in venture capital, 50% of your investments may not make it.
Yeah.
But the payoff profile compensates for that.
Right. So looking at those numbers now, and you know, at the rate of what you have to say no or yes to, when you just got started, and didn't you feel the pressure of, like, oh, I have to say yes to something?
You certainly do. In Silicon Valley, there's a saying that it takes $60 million to educate a venture capitalist.
Yes.
That's one of those figures I just came up with. Even with very smart people who've now been to best business schools and have corporate track records and so on, they have to make some mistakes, and you learn from those mistakes. So that's definitely one of the pressures is, you know, you need to pull the trigger. You now say you're in venture capital. Now, when are you going to say yes?
Yeah.
And then over time, you even learn from your own mistakes. And it's very important that you are honest with yourself and say, like, where did I go wrong?
Right.
I'm now actually at the end of my capacity to invest. I say it on the website, because I've only been looking after my own or the family's funds that we have at our disposal, and that's come to an end. And it's honestly frustrating, because I see so many more good deals. I see better deals now than I did at the beginning.
Right.
And I wish I hadn't, you know, been so eager to pull the trigger in the beginning. But that's all part of the education process or growing up as a venture capitalist.
Mm-hmm. So you write a lot, which I like, your writing style and the tweets as well. You have an article called "I Don't Want Your Money."
That's right.
I elaborate on that for...
Well, okay, I suppose the first thing is that I get many, many, many invites for coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in fact, it's... Much as I love coffee, by the way, when I get an email that says, can we go for coffee, it's quite frustrating, because a lot of people want to meet and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people want to sell you on their idea. And the really important message I wanted to get out there is that it's not about ideas. And I say this as a nerd or a geek, somebody who loves ideas, and I read all these books and so on. But a lot of people quite naively think an idea is the important thing, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's the actual implementation of the idea that is both tough and where it is really proven. So, I mean, I wrote that basically saying, don't come and see me just with ideas, and don't come and see me with, you know, wanting to drink coffee. But I am interested if your idea has gained traction, if you found an application for that idea in the real world, and that if you found people who are willing to pay for that. Then it starts getting interesting as an investor, because now you say, how can I now make that business that you have grow massively? How can I make it grow 10 times or 100 times more? Because now it's proven, and what is needed now is capital so that you can make that idea grow. And then I said, you know, now I'm very interested in meeting up with you and,
yes,
and talking about growth.
So one of the companies that you invested in, which are some of the companies that are outstanding to me, it's Rain and Bank X.
Yes, Bank
so,
Zero.
Oh, Bank Zero, sorry.
Yes.
So let's talk about Rain first, because I'm really excited about this.
Yeah.
So I put a post saying that I was doing an interview with you, and a lot of people are asking questions about it.
About Rain.
So how did you end up on that project, and how are you going to make it happen? And actually, I think the first question should be, why is data so expensive in South Africa?
And of course, those are all related. And data is too expensive in South Africa, just to get that out of the way pretty quickly. Therefore, it's a problem. It's a big problem in society, because the more people have access to the internet, the higher your economic growth. This has been proven. For every 10% increase in broadband access, you get an extra 1.5% growth. But it's the lifeline of the new economy. If you don't have internet access, you can't educate yourself as well as you would, because all the content to educate yourself in anything is out there available mostly for free. But you also don't have entertainment. You also don't know exactly what the news is. If you're a farmer, you don't know what the prices are. If you're a fisherman, you don't know where the fish is. You don't know what the weather's going to be like. It really is the new economy. So we got to get data right. I've always, in addition to banking, been fascinated by telecommunications.
Yes.
I must say some of it also comes from my previous boss and mentor, Paul Harris. He always had this thing about telcos. And if you think about it, it's very similar to banking. It's another product that's intangible, where billing is important, just like it is in banking, and where access to it is an underlying enabler of the economy and of all businesses. So even at FNB, when we brought in FNB Connect, which is a virtual mobile network operator that now, I believe, has more than 1 million customers, that was maybe my first foray into the telecommunications world. I'd been invested in a company called Multisource, together with the Harris family, and when one of these many applications that I saw came across my desk, or shall I say, into my email inbox, I was able to link it with the Multisource team. They very quickly saw that the biggest asset in this business was the spectrum that the company owned. And we saw that we could get rid of iBurst, which at that stage had become obsolete technology, and bring in 4G or LTE technology into that spectrum base. And in the process then, with the latest technology, bring down the cost of data in South Africa. So that's basically what we've done.
Okay.
We've started the first data-only service in South Africa, so it doesn't have traditional voice or SMS. Of course, you can speak if you use something like WhatsApp,
yeah,
but it's not the old voice, which makes it much cheaper. It's about 2 cents a minute in comparison with all the old rates. But more importantly, it's data-focused, and nearly everything today is an app.
Mm-hmm.
It can be WhatsApp for voice, but it can be every other app, from Facebook to Twitter to music to movies to whatever you need. So it's very exciting for us that we're launching this data-only service. Right now it's metropolitan only, but obviously over time we want to broaden that to the rest of South Africa. But we like that hashtag data must fall, and we think we are part of the solution to make data fall. Not only are we making it less expensive, we also saw pain points that the consumer has, like bundles, out of bundle, and expiry. And we just said, we're not going to have bundles,
yes,
and you pay for what you use,
yeah,
so therefore it's no bundle. No long-term contract, we don't lock you in, you just pay at the end of the month for what you used, and our data, mobile data, won't ever expire.
But why didn't MTN or say Vodacom and all the large telecom companies did this before?
You should ask them that question.
But why are they still expensive? I don't understand, it's like,
but sometimes,
why are they still expensive?
And this is what
makes it interesting as a startup, and why do you believe you know, the future is sometimes created more by startups than by the incumbents, is we didn't have legacy technology, and we don't have legacy revenue streams. So you have the complete freedom to completely rethink how you want to price.
Yes.
And we started by looking at what consumers were saying, and these things of expiry, big issue for them, out of bundle penalties, big issue, being locked into long-term contracts, a big issue. So you listen to what the customer wanted, and then you can launch with something completely new. Sometimes that's a lot tougher doing if you're an existing business and you have existing technology and existing revenue streams.
Right, and but what was the challenge, though, for you to come up with that?
The big shortage in South Africa is of spectrum,
okay.
But that was, you know, the asset that we had recognized in the company that we bought. And then the second one is obviously this is a very capital intensive business.
Okay.
So as you roll out, it's a lot of capital that you need to deploy. We found a good solution in that we are also selling our services on a wholesale roaming basis to one of the big companies, and that gives us the financing to also roll out. And then we quite recently launched Rain. It's only available online, which is another new innovation. In doing so, we can bring the costs down even more, and with lower costs, we can pass those benefits on to customers so that we can make mobile data affordable.
So now I understand more. A lot of people were thinking that, oh, this, you know, the way you're selling the data, it's just like at a promotional base, maybe for the next 3 or 5 months, and then it will be at the same price rate as the others.
I saw some of those tweets as well,
yeah,
where people said it can't be true, and some people said it's a hoax, and they've all like all types of jokes. It's not just rain, but also hail and snow and etc. No, but it really is the truth.
Yeah.
We only have one price plan. We also didn't want to make it complicated, that we think the market is full of complicated offers. It's 5 cents a meg or 50 rands a gig, which is the same thing, and you only pay for as much as you use. It isn't a special offer. That's the offer that we intend sticking with. In time, we even think it can go lower. Data prices are, in fact, going lower, you know, even without our entry. The use of data worldwide, mobile data, is growing at 60% compound. And this has been a trend that's been evident for decades, and we think will still last decades. So, and as that use grows, there are also economies of scale in supplying it also with new tech. So the cost of data will come down from where it is now, even further.
Another question that came on that subject was, when are you going to roll it out to, like, out of, you know, the metropolitan areas?
Over time, we are obviously, realized coverage is very important. We are just over 2,100 sites right now. We have plans in the next 2.5 years to get that up to 5,000. Obviously, we first place them where there's the biggest need for it, which is in metropolitan areas. But over time, that will spread out. There's also a science here that the lower the frequency of your spectrum, the broader it can reach. So what all the operators are after are the sub 800 megahertz spectrum, which we don't have, but if we have that, we would be able to cover more and more of the rural areas in South Africa as well. For now, it's a metropolitan first, data first service.
Right. Now let's jump to Bank Zero. And yeah, well, that's also another exciting idea.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's not launched yet.
Yeah.
We are in the final stages of getting our license with the South African Reserve Bank, which I must tell you has been an incredibly professional process. I can only you know, take my hat off to the regulators for the high standards that they have, and you know, maybe the hoops that they've made us jump through. But you know, in going through the process, one realizes that the South African banking system is in really, really solid hands. So we're in the final stages, as I say, of getting the license. And what happens after that is the integration into the various payments systems of South Africa, so that you can, for example, have your card swiped anywhere, your card used at any ATM to draw cash, and that you can have debit orders and or make payments to other banks. The big feature of Bank Zero is the incredibly low cost base that it has. And I must say, even in having run a very large bank, if somebody had told me that it's possible to develop an entire banking system and all the apps needed for it and all the backup for it, at the cost at which we have, I would not have believed them. So the world has changed in amazing ways, that there are now well-tested
open source software programs available that one can just use to construct an entire banking system and the apps that I've spoken about, so that the barrier to entry is low, for at least from a financial perspective, the cost barrier, and that one can therefore, again, leverage those cost benefits back to the customer. So our name is a bit of a giveaway, Bank Zero. Yeah. We do think that electronic transactions should be free, mm-hmm. as they are, for example, in the crypto world. And that would be quite a big benefit to South African consumers and to South African businesses who arguably are paying far too much for their electronic banking fees.
Just break it down exactly for some people who don't understand. Yes. What kind of bank is this?
So it's an app-based bank. You'll have to have a smartphone, an advanced smartphone, to use these banking facilities.
By the way, when you say advanced smartphone, you pretty much mean most of the smartphones.
Yes, although we'd like to build in additional security features, for example, fingerprints, which some of the latest phones come with, or other forms of biometrics, which could be facial recognition, voice recognition. Location is quite important for us. You know, if we suddenly see the phone is somewhere where it's never been used before, that would set off a red light somewhere. So in that sense, we think modern or the latest smartphones have many security features which internet banking don't have.
Yeah.
It can actually be your most secure banking access mechanism. So we'll have an app on smartphones plus a card. And the reason you need the card is just much of real life transactions today are still done by either swiping a card at a shop or using it to draw cash. So it'll be an app plus a card. As I said, from a pricing perspective, we'd like to make all electronic transactions, and that includes card swipes, free. We think we're able to do that because we have a very low cost base. And then we hope to launch with the service in the beginning of 2019. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what the response is from South Africans. But we think there is a segment of the market that is either young or tech-savvy enough or irritated enough by high bank fees that they will join this new bank.
I'm not irritated as much with the fees. I'm just irritated by just the whole operation of, like, when I need to open a bank account.
Yes.
Why can't I just sit home and do it?
Yes. So we've re-engineered, or we've looked at every process, and we've tried to make it as easy as possible for the customer. Now, clearly, there are certain things you do need to have their details. There are certain regulations that we need to adhere to, like FICA, the Know Your Customer regulations. But there are also clever ways of doing some of those things electronically or in ways that are easy for the customer, even if you as an institution need to do a lot more work.
Yeah.
But it's, so we want to make the bank account opening process and or switching process as hassle-free as possible for new customers. But we've also come up with, at last I counted, 13 new features that we haven't seen banks in the rest of the world adopt. Things that will make banking a whole lot easier,
right,
that I can't disclose yet, that will all be disclosed at launch. So it's not just about price and lower fees. It will be about new functionality that mobility enables that just weren't part of banking systems before.
Are you going to have any kind of banking facilities, like traditional banks for this?
You're talking about lending facilities now?
Yeah.
No, we want to actually launch without lending. And the reason for that is that we think it's higher risk, and we want to first focus on the lower risk parts of the market. Secondly, we think the market is actually well served with lending. You could argue that we, in South Africa, lend too easily, and we should be saving a bit more, like some of the growing nations in the East do. So we want to particularly incentivize savings through good rates on deposits, and we want to particularly attack payments in South Africa, because we think it's payments where the fees generally in the market are too high. So we're going to focus on those areas where there's a bigger social need than lending.
Is it going to be, are you guys going to have like branches, or just 100%
No,
digital?
It's going to be completely mobile. And clearly there are some people who still want to go to branches and want to have face-to-face interactions, and that's good for them. But we think there's a segment of the market, and again, typically maybe the younger part or the tech-savvy part, who don't have that specific need to go into branches.
Yes. If I never had to go to the bank, it's like, thank you.
A lot of people say that.
Yeah.
And that it's a form of self-service, right? Mm. So many years ago, if you went into a lift, there would be somebody in the lift that would ask you which floor would you like to go to, and then press the button for you. So in some ways, branches are that today. You know, you go to the branch and you ask them to make a payment or a transfer or for a statement, and it's possible for you to do all those things just on your mobile phone. So and have it immediately, and you don't have to wait in a queue. So why wouldn't you?
Right. So, in all the things that you have done, what would you, with all you know right now, say, let's go back at 20 years old. Mm-hmm. If you were 20 years old right now at Stellenbosch University, or maybe just out of college, what would you have looked into to do?
What would I have done differently? It's very simple, and I think about that a lot, is I would take many more risks.
Okay.
So I probably come from a generation where your parents encouraged less risk-taking, or your teachers, you know, study hard, get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realize now in life is that the more risks you're willing to take, the better your quality of life and the higher your rewards. So I'm not advocating stupid risks. I'm not saying, you know, jump off a cliff or anything like that. That's a stupid risk. I would say take very smart risks. Study the field, whatever that field is, and get to know everything about it. And then by doing so, you actually reduce the risk because of knowledge.
Yes.
But then take those risks. So if it's 10 or 20 years ago, if you're a youngster, you know, if that business that you start doesn't work, so what? It's not a big deal. You've learned out of it, start another business, you know, learn in the process. So I definitely think that I would have liked to take smarter risks all over. And that means in one end, in traveling the world more, exposing yourself to more people in the world, meeting more people, you know, starting my own business much, much earlier than going to some of these big corporates. And mm-hmm. that would still be my message to all the kids today.
So how do you meet, like, people that you look up to at 20? You just come out of college.
You know, a lot of people want to actually physically meet other people. I think that's not necessary anymore because there are so many books out there. There are so many things written. There are so many TED Talks. Access to all the knowledge in the world, if you look for it, is available mostly for free. And you know, I'd like to think that every book that you see here behind me, and I have many more at home, those are all my mentors. So you don't need to physically meet Steve Jobs to learn from Steve Jobs or any of these other names. Read up about them, go online and see what they've spoken about, and you can learn a lot more.
And who do you look up to?
Like many people. I mean, in South Africa, it's just too easy to say Mandela, and obviously it's Mandela. And I met him once in my life, and I couldn't get a word out, or maybe I did say something I just can't remember. I was so awestruck by the person. But the reality is, I get my kicks out of not one or two or five people, but out of many people. I get my kicks out of meeting energetic people who have interesting angles on life or business or the world every single day. And it's just making the most out of those particular interactions where you can. But I'm equally comfortable meeting those people in inverted commas through reading their writing, you know. Think about it. If they've written a book, they've gone to the trouble of expressing their thoughts on paper.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for them to repeat it when you meet them in person. You can go to the book, read it in your own time, make notes of what you want. Mm-hmm. So sometimes meeting people is the lazy way of being mentored, and the right way to do it is to read. I've yet to meet really smart people in the world that don't read a lot. There we go. It may sound boring to some youngsters, but you know, if you fall in love with reading, you're going to do very well in life.
So if you had to meet someone, though, who would that person be? Like, you know, if I had to meet this guy, dead or alive?
You see, having now met Mandela once in my life and being so dumbfounded I couldn't get a word out, you know, I could come up with names now, but I'm just not sure whether that meeting would result in the kind of high-level discussion that it necessarily deserves, or that maybe my expectations would be too high. I mean, some of the very high-profile people that I've met in life, my impression after having met them is that they are ordinary people like you and me. You know, they have no magic potion or specific immediate quality.
Mm-hmm.
You could even be therefore disappointed in meeting, you know, that person that you looked up to all the time. So I have to say, where I sit now, I don't have any big aspirations of meeting anyone in particular because, as I said earlier, I feel I have access to whatever their thoughts are through reading. So I get more joy right now out of, you know, seeing my kids again or my family or my mates than I do out of meeting some of those big names out there.
Before we get to the questions let's take a look at that a little bit more. So you said, but you know, now if you had to write a book, it would be probably about family and friends. You said that you didn't do well in that part of life in your early years.
Yeah.
But do you think you could have managed to achieve the same thing that you have achieved and still be able to keep the balance?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. I also think that's a fallacy out there, the work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, it's possible if you don't really take your work that seriously. But if you really want to achieve something big in the world, you have to make trade-offs. You know, you can't be the best tennis player in the world and still be, I don't know, the best at a corporate career and be the best at, you know, all your mates and so on. You have to dedicate extraordinary time at being the best tennis player. And so it is with those corporate jobs. I mean, if I look back at it now, I think I was completely occupied with it. You know, whenever an email came in or a tweet or something about the business, I would react immediately, even though I was with my family. And that, of course, is wrong, you know, because it takes you out of being with them in the now. So I can console myself with that a little bit, saying you can only achieve what you want to achieve by making those type of trade-offs. And I'm fortunate to now be in a position where I don't have to do that anymore, and I can, you know, spend disproportionate time back with friends and family and hope that they forgive me for those years that I wasn't fully present.
Mm-hmm. And now when you get a tweet, you don't have to check it or email it.
No, but again, I'm privileged.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to believe that I work myself into a position in life where that is
yes.
the case now, where I'm no longer as addicted to my phone or to the messages coming in. I try very hard also in the businesses where I'm involved to be involved in the strategic and not an operational level,
right?
Because that, you know, that thing of having to take a phone call from a customer at any time of day is something that I did for many, many years, and just would like to not have to do anymore.
Right. But you think that for an entrepreneur who is trying to get things out, that's what they have to do.
You have to make sacrifices. You have to make trade-offs. It's better that people know about that up front. To do a startup is very, very tough. It takes you out of your comfort zone all day long. The hours are very long. They can be very lonely. Things go wrong. They inevitably do. There's, you know, not that big safety net to fall back on.
Yeah.
If you can do it, it is one of the best schools of life to ever done. You will learn more in starting your own business than you could ever learn in theory, like by doing an MBA. You will learn more about yourself, about your own value system, what character you are. You'll learn more about the people you work with than you could ever do in an interview. You know, you'll see how they respond under pressure. So there's something romantic about it being so tough.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very tough. So as much as I would encourage people to take risks, and in many cases that means being an entrepreneur, starting a business, or being part of an entrepreneurial team, you would be setting them up for failure if they didn't realize that it's not just all going to be about optimism and pizzas and collegiality. There are going to be some really tough times, long hours, and you need to have the endurance to work through that to create a successful business.
So what are the tough times that you can recall from previously that you can look up to now? Like, you know, that wasn't a good time, but I'm thankful for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, look, the many, I wish there weren't so many. Definitely at the bank, there were occasions where the systems fell over.
Mm.
And that is an immense responsibility if you think about the fact that there's somebody who now needs to pay for a bill and they can't and they turned away and they lose face.
Mm.
Or a guy who wants to take, you know, the girl of his dreams out, and when he pays for the meal, it gets declined. Or somebody fills up their car, and then the car's now filled up, and they can't pay. So I mean, those were just tough times. And some of the lessons, for what it's worth, was just keeping open channels of communications with your customer and being humble and giving them feedback. Possibly the toughest things in business for me always revolved around people.
Mm.
As a leader, it's important who you surround yourself with. As I said, it's always trying to do it with people who are smarter than you. But sometimes realizing that the people in your team aren't the right people and having to confront that, it's very tough for me because I'm not naturally a person who likes a conflict. Or in a broader sense, when cost cuts had to be made and, you know, people had to leave the company, and it wasn't their fault.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, where the company found itself. Those were some of the very tough things. And there again, I think what I learned is the brutal honesty, the brutal authenticity of sitting in front of somebody and being very, very direct with them and saying, you know, why is it that this has to happen? It's not fun for either party, but what at least you owe people in that position is the brutal truth. And that's something I still try and practice.
So, in context in which they say the employee is underperforming and that's the only reason you're laying him off, how do you communicate that?
It's still being very, very direct. letting people know where they stand all along. Should it come to the end of a journey, that it isn't a surprise for them because it's the same thing that you've been focusing on for some time. So having very clear, measurable objectives and having regular discussions with that person, and also trying to help them improve, because your intent isn't to fire them. Your intent is that they actually start performing and start performing well for themselves and also for the company. So you have that type of intent, but because you are direct all along and you know what the outcomes are, and if they're not met, as long as it's not a surprise for the individual, then I think you've done your job well as a manager or a leader.
Right. So a friend of mine, Michael Jordan, that's his name as well, he says, what are your personal views on capitalism, and if you see any flaws in the ideology after working so many years at the heart of the South African economy?
Yeah, okay, a good question. I do believe in the market, because the market has a way of allocating things to where there's scarcity. It finds out scarcity, puts a price on that, and then you can use incentives to solve that problem. So I do like the market, but it has shortcomings, and you need to complement the market with social policy. So that's my basic view. I'm a social marketeer. Mm-hmm. Is there are certain areas where the market is better, and there's certain things where social policy is better. Capitalism has been very good at bringing us a whole range of innovations. You know, you could argue you wouldn't have the iPhone, and you wouldn't have the modern standard of living, and you know, the cars we drive in, and the TV that we have, and the internet, if it hadn't been for businesses. But at the same time, government has a role to play where there are market failures, to sort out the inequality, which is probably one of the really, really big concerning things out of capitalism. So every country has to find that right mix between the market and social policy. I think there's a lot that we can learn from the rest of the world. So my issue with the big debate that we have in the world about inequality and capitalism, socialism and communism is it's a very ideologically laden debate. It's sometimes a very emotive debate. And I think it shouldn't be either of those things. It should be data-based. Mm-hmm. One should say, which are the countries that are growing the fastest, that are getting their citizens out of poverty the fastest? What are they doing that we could learn from and do the same?
Mm-hmm.
And whether that means privatizing the national airline or nationalizing, you know, the hospital system, whatever that is, let's go to countries and come up with facts that say, these seems to be the right way of doing it. We are not alone in this. There are countries that are ahead of us on the growth curve. Obviously, we are still an emerging country. Let's go and learn from the ones that work. I think it will ultimately be the right balance between the market and the social construct.
Right. And he also say, can you correct the spelling of your name? Why do you have
two A's? When I do travel in the States, I can tell them I'm Jordan, but I become Jordan very, very quickly. Right. So I just have to accept that.
Oh, so how do you pronounce your...
It's Jordan.
Jordan.
But, you know, when it's English, I'll be Jordan.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Even if I say I'm Jordan, I'll become Jordan very quickly in their heads.
Another question from the comments. Why is the rain seam 120 Rand, and when is it getting to pet stores?
So it's a delivery fee,
mm-hmm.
Because we sell it directly. So that is the actual cost of the delivery, plus the cost of the SIM, plus the fact that we recode you in the process, which we think is a good deal, because you would have to travel to a store,
yes.
And you would have to do the recode process there, and you buy the SIM there as well. So we recognize it's a fee though, and for that you get 15 days of unlimited free data, which we think is a really, really mm-hmm. great deal. We will be looking at other distribution channels as well. Up till now, what troubles us about that is that they get a quite a high percentage of ongoing revenue. So if you still use that SIM 3 years from now, some people who distribute get a percentage of the income. We would rather keep the costs low and pass those benefits on to customers so that
yes.
the end cost remains low. And that is the reason why we've chosen a direct model.
Right. And lastly, what are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies?
Cryptos.
Yeah.
I like cryptos. I like the crypto world. I'm bullish on the sector as a whole. I'm bullish about blockchain. I think distributed ways of looking at the world is the future, not just in currencies, but in everything from solar power to communications. I need to say that I was very worried about the clear speculative bubble that had developed towards the end of last year. Who knows, it may still even be there, because there are just too many people who want to make quick money through ICOs and through launching their own currency. But speculative frenzies aside, the underlying technology, I think, is brilliant and can solve many of the real-world hassles that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it shouldn't take 2 months to transfer property. There's no reason why that can't be done immediately.
Yes.
The moment a buyer and seller agree, you should be able to transfer that property. That's just kind of one example. So the real test for cryptos now is that people, probably entrepreneurial teams, develop real-life solutions to problems that we have using distributed ledger technology. And then I think it will get far more widespread adoption. And I suppose that could also then increase the underlying value of some of the coins or tokens that are used in the process. So I'm bullish on it. Philosophically, I really like the fact that it's distributed. Some of the things I don't like is that we don't scale that well yet. So from a payments perspective, I'd love to, you know, see Bitcoin do many more transactions per second.
Yeah.
I also would prefer if we could find a way of mining Bitcoin that isn't so energy intensive. I do realize that the current banking system also uses a lot of energy, but you know, that's no reason why we should be spending a lot of energy on mining Bitcoin. But these are all problems that I think will be solved in time. Scalability, energy consumption, use of blockchain for real world applications with real world benefits like immediacy. So it's a very, very exciting technology that is actually still in its infancy, and I do think it'll be revolutionary and change the world. We just need time to implement.
So you definitely like proof of stake algorithms?
Yeah, I would say that that is definitely where we've got to go, and so instead of proof of work as we currently have it.
Right. So you and I share the same love for electric cars, or actually,
yes,
you know, the current transport system, the way it's changing.
Yes.
I also don't think that one should have a car right now.
Yes.
You know, I sold my car over a year ago.
Well,
I had one for a year, and it's awesome, actually.
Did you come here? How did you get here?
Uber.
You used Uber? Yes, of course. And
yeah.
I find it's very convenient nowadays.
Exactly.
I do have a car. I've got a very old car. I think it's 12 years old now. My kids don't want to drive in it anymore. I still love it.
Mm.
But I've decided I'm not getting rid of that until I can buy myself a proper electric car.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that'll probably be in 2020, you know, when the models arrive in South Africa, and there's also sufficient charging infrastructure.
So I was
about
to ask you about that. Do you think investing in charging stations right now would be a bad idea?
I think it's probably a good idea in the sense that you don't need all the infrastructure that you need with a fuel station. You don't need to go and dig, you know, big things into the earth. It really is just an electric cable that you can have out there. I think you've got to recognize that the barrier to entry is, in that sense, also quite low. And if you do it right now, there may not yet be enough cars to do it.
Yes.
And it could also even be that existing petrol stations just add another electric plug that
All
they
right.
do want to add there. Finally, it's very easy to charge this thing at home.
Mm-hmm.
So people can do it overnight, and you know, maybe electricity tariffs are lower then because there's less of a base load. But what I do think is going to happen is that employers will start offering this as a perk. So if you drive to work with your electric car, you could charge it there, and that's because the cost of charging is so
right.
low. Then again, I think in the fullness of time, we will not only have electric cars, we'll also have autonomous cars.
Mm-hmm.
So the future is probably one where your autonomous car can take you to work, and then you will, while you're at work, put the car to work.
Yes.
And it will, you know, ferry other passengers around.
Mm-hmm.
So there are very, very many interesting things going to happen in the future. And like you, it's fun to kind of live in the future already, to say, do I really need a car today? Can't I just take an Uber? And it's just great when that pans out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think Rain is like that. We've just said we're not going to go into old school voice, just into data.
Yeah.
I'd like to think Bank Zero is like that. We're not going to go into branches and providing cash ourselves. It's all going to be mobile, because that's the way that banking will be in future. And those are the exciting things about starting new businesses, is you see where the macro trends are going and just jump in there, and hopefully the market catches up with us in about 2 or 3 years.
So you said buying a car right now, it's like what?
Yeah, wouldn't make sense. And again, I think the youngsters who get it,
yeah.
there are people living in cities who get that. And then there's the older generation who don't get that at all, because buying a car was like the most important thing in becoming an adult, and it was the most important thing in, I don't know, impressing girlfriends. The mobility that you got was the most important part of becoming free, in a way, more important than, you know, many other things in life, was having your own set of wheels. But if you can now get from A to B and somebody else drives you there and it's cheaper,
get some work done while you're on the road.
In a stress-free basis, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's the way of the future.
Right. So in the world of RAIN and Bank Zero and everything else, what do you see in the future, say 7 years from now? What would the world look like?
So I'm a techno-optimist. Mm. I think there are a whole range of technologies that will just make us far more efficient in how we use our time.
Mm.
This will make everything from education to entertainment much better.
Mm.
One of the things that we haven't done well as a society is then decide how we use all of that technology for society's overall benefit. And what I mean with that is all these time savings. Let's say you have a technology that helps you save time. Are we now going to work less? Or are we just going to keep on working the same amount of hours and just get more done?
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, where we have many problems, one of our biggest problems is unemployment. And I hope that we have the wisdom to use some of these technologies to reduce unemployment. Now, there are ways in which we could do it. One would be more education.
Mm-hmm.
Another one would actually be to work less. You know, so if we have a shorter working week or we work less days of the week, then there would hopefully be more work available to get more people into the economy.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a techno-optimist, but I think it depends on us as business people and as policymakers to decide how we are going to use all the benefits that come through technology in a way that it doesn't just benefit the few, but that we can benefit more people in society.
Right. I don't want to waste too much of your time.
Not at all.
Amazing. Just lastly,
yes.
Just elaborate, just share a little bit of, I mean, some of the people will read I Don't Want Your Money. I'll put the link on.
No.
But you spoke about when investing with the guys with suits.
Yes.
just share a little
it's,
bit.
It's a counter indicator. So if people want to start startups,
mm-hmm.
it's really important that they're good on substance. That they know their topic, that they know their market, that they know whatever the tech is that they're using, that they know who they're competing against. But what isn't important is form.
Mm.
You know, if they arrive wearing a suit, that probably means that they're paying disproportionate attention to form.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of an unwritten rule in most of the venture capital world that, you know, those are the people you shouldn't back. The real entrepreneurs don't really care much how they dress and what they look like, but they care deeply about the problem that they try and solve. So you won't impress me if you come and see me in a suit, but you will impress me if you really, really, really know your business and you know your stuff and you find yourself in that last 2% of knowledge, because it's on those fringes where all the difference is truly made.
One of my favorite books is Zero to One.
Yes.
So Peter Thiel actually shares the same.
Yes.
Philosophy, but I think it also applies in many different ways in life.
Yes. I love that book, even though I differ from it in many instances.
Okay.
I think it's important to also read books where you differ from the point of view, otherwise you get involved in just your own echo chamber.
Yeah.
But certainly the way he defines business as, you know, creating something completely new, to go from zero, which is nothing, to one, which is a completely new thing, is a great way to think about your business. I prefer to think about it a little bit differently, which is solve a very real problem in society.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the fact that there is a problem means there is a vacuum or a void that needs to be filled. So do something real. You know, so if I had to write a book, I mean, the title would be, you know, do stuff that matters or do something real.
You should.
Exactly.
And the monopoly aspect of it?
That troubles me, because as an economist, monopolies are bad. So clearly, Thiel makes a good point there. Where he says, as a business, you should set out trying to be a monopoly. I get that can be the intent of somebody, dominate the way Facebook or Google does. Whether that ultimately is good for society, that I'm just not convinced of. I prefer markets that are very, very competitive, because that means in the long run, you don't just have lock-in of customers. You have to continually keep on improving. So I actually don't think monopolies are good for economy. I think the real thing we need to be against is monopolies.
So do you think the monopoly is an intimate intention of a business owner, it's just an unsaid. It just goes unsaid, but then it sounds somehow not right when it's said.
So in business, you want to win, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be better than the competition. And if you keep on winning, I suppose the ultimate form of that is that you could become a monopoly. But that is wrong. That I would see then as a market failure. So as much as I believe in the market, once you have markets that are dominated by single institutions that become too strong, mm-hmm. They can atrophy, and then there will be a lack of innovation in the long run.
Yes.
So consumers should have choices, and I think those choices are very important. So even though that may be something that you as an entrepreneur or business owner may want for selfish reasons, that I think is where it's not the right thing for the economy as a whole.
Right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This was fun.
No, perfect. It was fun. Great questions. You showed insight in your questions. Right. And I hope.
Hello once again, and that was the end of our conversation. And just before you go, just want to communicate a few things with you quickly. If you have enjoyed any of the podcasts or this specific podcast episode, I would appreciate it if you share it with your friends and family through your social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc., etc., as well as write me a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Podcast app. That would be fantastic. It helps me flourish and sustain this podcast as well. We also on other platforms like SoundCloud, Stitcher Radio, and all other major podcast platforms. So whichever way you're listening to it, I would appreciate it if you leave me a review. You can also subscribe to the Grey Podcast through my website, greyjabesi.com, greyjabesi.com. There you also find some of the blogs that I'm writing sometimes, and you get notified as soon as the new episode has been published. Until next time, enjoy and be productive. Thank you.